Then why give it to me? She could pretend a lack of interest, but Zachariah wondered what she would say if he asked for it back. He suspected he would have a fight on his hands. Because I have a feeling it belongs to you and to your family. She stiffened, and Brother Zachariah marked the minute twitch of her hand, as if instinctively reaching for a weapon. She had sharp instincts, but also self-control and arrogance, grace and loyalty, and the capacity for great love, and a laugh that could light up the sky. He had come to Paris looking for the lost Herondale, and he had found her.
I don't know what you're talking about.
You are the Herondale, not your husband. You, the lost heir to a noble line of warriors.
I'm nobody, she snapped. Nobody of interest to you, at least.
I could reach into your mind and confirm the truth. She flinched. Zachariah didn't have to read her mind to understand her panic or her welling self-doubt as she scrambled to figure out how he had seen through the ruse. But I would not trespass on your secrets. I want only to help you.
My parents told me everything I need to know about the Shadow Hunters, she said, and Brother Zachariah understood this was as close to an admission as he was going to get. Your precious little clave, your law. She spit out the last word like it was poison.
I am not here as a representative of the clave. They have no idea I've come to you, or even that you exist. I have my own reasons for finding you, for wanting to protect you.
And they are?
I would not trespass on your secrets, and I would ask that you not trespass on mine. Know only that I owe a great debt to your family. The bonds holding me to the Herondales run deeper than blood.
Well, that's nice of you and all, but no one asked you to pay any debts, Rosemary said. Jack and I are doing just fine, taking care of each other, and that's what we'll keep doing.
It was clever of you to make it seem as if your husband was the one I sought, but...
It was clever of Jack. People underestimate him, and they pay for it.
But if I could penetrate your ruse, others who seek you may as well, and they are more dangerous than you know.
These others you talk about butchered my parents.
Rosemary's face betrayed no expression.
Jack and I had been on the run for years. Trust me, I know exactly how dangerous this is, and I know exactly how dangerous it is to trust a stranger, even a stranger with psychic ninja powers and a deeply weird fashion sense.
One of the things Brother Zachariah had learned in the Silent Brotherhood was the power of acceptance. Sometimes it was stronger to recognize an unwinnable fight and accept defeat, the better to begin laying groundwork for the next battle. Though this was not a battle, he reminded himself. You could not war for a person's trust. You could only earn it. Your Heron necklace now has an enchantment on it. If you encounter trouble you cannot face on your own, you need only summon me and I will come.
If you think you can track us through this thing...
Your husband suggested that the only way to earn trust is by offering it. I will not try to find you if you prefer not to be found. But with this pendant, you can always find me. I trust you will summon me for help, if and when you need. Please trust that I will always answer.
And who are you, exactly?
You may call me Brother Zachariah.
I could, but if I end up in this hypothetical situation where I need my life saved by some bloodthirsty monk, I'd rather know his actual name.
I was once. It had been so long he almost didn't feel entitled to the name, but there was a deep, nearly human pleasure in allowing himself to claim it. I was once known as James Carstairs. Jem.
So who will you summon when you encounter trouble you can't face on your own, Jem?
She fastened the pendant around her neck, and Zachariah felt a sliver of relief. At least he'd accomplished that much. I don't anticipate that.
Then you're not paying attention.
She touched him on the shoulder then, unexpectedly, and with unexpected gentleness.
Thank you for trying, she said. It's a start.
Then he was watching her walk away. Brother Zachariah watched the water stream beneath the bridge. He thought about that other bridge, in another city, where once a year he returned to remember the man he'd once been, and the dreams that man had once had.
At the far end of the Pont des Arts, a young street musician opened a violin case and raised the instrument to his chin. For a moment, Zachariah thought he was imagining it, that he had conjured up a fantasy of his former self. But as he drew closer, because he could not stay away, he realized the musician was a girl. She was young, no more than 14 or 15, her hair swept up beneath a newsboy cap, a neat, old-fashioned bow tie at the collar of her white blouse. She bowed the strings and began to play a haunting melody. Brother Zachariah recognized it, Bartok Violin Concerto, that had been written well after Jem Carstairs had put down his violin. Silent Brothers played no music. They didn't listen to music either, not in the ordinary way. But even with their senses sealed off to mortal pleasures, they still heard. Jem heard. He was glamored. The musician must have assumed she was alone. There was no audience for her music, no possibility of payment. She wasn't playing for spare change, but for her own pleasure. She faced the water, the sky. This was a song to welcome the sun. Distantly, he remembered the soft pressure of the chin rest. He remembered his fingertips capering across the strings. He remembered the dance of the bow. He remembered how, sometimes, it had felt like the music was playing him. There was no music in the silent city. There was no sun, no dawn. There was only dark. There was only quiet. Paris was a city that luxuriated in the senses, food, wine, art, romance. Everywhere was a reminder of what he'd lost, the pleasures of a world no longer his. He had learned to live with the loss. It was harder when he immersed himself in the world like this, but it was bearable. This was something else, though. The nothing he felt as he listened to the melody, watched the bow waltz up and down the strings, the great hollow it opened inside him, echoing only with the past, that made him feel utterly, dismally inhuman. The longing he felt to truly hear, to want, to feel, that made him feel almost alive. "Come home," the brothers whispered in his mind. "It is time." Over the years, as he'd gained more control, Brother Zachariah had learned how to isolate himself from the voices of his brothers when need be. It was a strange thing, the brotherhood. Most assumed it was a lonely, solitary life. And it was, indeed, solitary. But he was never truly alone. The brotherhood was always there, on the edge of his awareness, watching, waiting. Brother Zachariah needed only extend a hand, and the brotherhood would reclaim him. "Soon," he promised them. "But not yet. I have more business here." He was more silent brother than not, but he was still less silent brother than the others. It was a strange liminal space, one that allowed him a modicum of privacy, and a desire for it that his brothers had long since abandoned. Zacharias shut himself off from them for the moment. He felt a deep regret over his failure here, but it was good, it was human, to feel regret, and he wanted to savor it, all on his own. Or maybe not all on his own. There was, in fact, one more piece of business before he could return to the Silent City. He needed to explain himself to the one person who cared as much about the Herondales as he did. He needed Tessa. Celine didn't go to Valentine's apartment intending to break in. That would have been madness. And anyway, after a night and day of blindly wandering the city, she was too sleep-deprived to form clear intentions of anything. She simply followed a whim. She wanted the certainty that settled over her in Valentine's presence, the power he had to make her believe, not just in him, but in herself. After her strange encounter on the bridge, she'd considered going back to the flat in the Marais. She knew Stephen and Robert should be apprised of the unexpected demon activity, the possibility of a rogue shadow hunter causing trouble and spreading suspicion about the circle. She couldn't face them. Let them worry about what had become of her. Or not worry. She no longer cared. At least she was trying very hard not to care. She'd spent the day in the Louvre, haunting galleries that none of the tourists cared to see. Old Etruscan masks and Mesopotamian coins. She spent hours there when she was younger, blending in with the hordes of school children. It was easy, when you were a child, to go unseen. The challenge, Celine understood now, was to be seen, and once seen, to endure judgment. She couldn't stop thinking about the couple on the bridge, the way they'd gazed at each other, the way they'd touched each other with so much care and so much need. Nor could she stop thinking about the woman's warning about Valentine. Celine was certain she could trust Valentine with her life. But if she'd been so wrong about Stephen, how could she know for sure she was right about anything? Valentine was staying in opulent quarters in the 6th arrondissement, down the street from a famous chocolatier and maiserie where the custom hats cost more than most people spent on rent. She knocked loudly. When no one answered, it was easy enough to pick the lock.
"I am breaking into Valentine Morgenstern's apartment," she thought, bewildered by herself. It didn't seem quite real.
The apartment was elegant, almost regal. Walls draped with gold fleur-de-lis, furniture covered with velvet. Plush rugs dotted the gleaming hardwood floors, heavy golden curtains dimmed the light. The room's only anachronism was a large glass case in the center, inside of which lay Dominique de Foix, bound, beaten, and unconscious. Before she could decide what to do, there was a sound of a key rattling in the lock. The doorknob turned. Without thinking, Celine dove behind the thick curtains. She held herself very, very still. From her hiding spot, she couldn't see Valentine pacing back and forth across the living room, but she could hear everything she needed to.
"Wake up," he snapped. There was a pause, a rustling, and then a woman's yelp of pain. "Helpless demons," he said, sounding halfway between amused and enraged. "Really?"
"You told me to make it look real," Dominique whined.
"Yes, I told you to make it look real, not endanger them."
"You also told me you'd pay, but here I am, in some kind of cage, with an empty wallet and a couple unseemly lumps on my head."
Valentine sighed heavily, as if this were all an irritating imposition on his time.
"You told them exactly what we agreed upon, yes? And signed the confession?"
"Isn't that what the little brats told you when they dumped me here? So how about you pay me for my services and we can forget this ever happened?"
"Gladly."
There was a strange sound, one that Celine couldn't place. Then a smell, one that she could. Burnt flesh. Valentine cleared his throat.
"You can come out now, Celine."
She froze. Didn't so much catch her breath as lose the ability to breathe.
"Not very good at subterfuge lately, are we? Come on now, show yourself."
He clapped his hands together sharply as if summoning a pet.
"No more games."
Celine stepped out from behind the curtains, feeling like a fool.
"You knew I was here? The whole time?"
"You would be surprised what all I know, Celine."
Valentine smiled coldly. As always, he was dressed in all black, which made his white blonde hair seem to glow with pale fire. Celine supposed that by objective standards, Valentine was just as handsome as Stephen. But it was impossible to think of him that way. He was handsome the way a statue was handsome, perfectly sculpted, unyielding as stone. Sometimes at the academy, Celine would watch him with Jocelyn, wondering at the way a single touch from her could melt his ice. Once Celine had come upon them in an embrace and had watched from the shadows as they lost themselves in each other. When they broke from the kiss, Valentine had raised a hand to Jocelyn's cheek in an impossibly tender touch, and his expression, as he gazed at his first and only love, was almost human. There was no trace of that in him now. He opened his arms wide as if welcoming her to make herself at home in the opulent living room. The cage at the center was empty, except for a smoldering pile of black lace and leather. Dominique de Foix was gone. Valentine followed her gaze.
"She was a criminal," he said. "I simply expedited the inevitable sentence."
There were rumors about Valentine, about the change that had come over him when his father was killed. dark whispers about the cruelties he carried out not just on trespassing downworlders, but on anyone who crossed him. Anyone who questioned him.
You look worried, Celine. Even afraid.
No, she said quickly.
It's almost as if you think breaking into my apartment to spy on me might draw some kind of nasty consequence.
I wasn't spying. I was just... He favored her with a smile then, so warm, so sunny, that she felt ridiculous for having been so afraid.
Would you settle for tea? And maybe some biscuits? You look like you haven't eaten in a year.
He set out a bounty, not just tea and biscuits, but a sliced baguette, fresh chèvre, and a small pot of honey, a bowl of blueberries that tasted like they'd just been plucked from the branch. Celine hadn't known she was hungry until the taste of honey hit her tongue. She realized she was ravenous.
They made polite Paris small talk. Their favorite cafes, their preferred picnic spots, the best crepe stand, the relative merits of the Orsay and the Pompidou.
Then Valentine took a hearty bite of cheese-smeared baguette and said, almost cheerfully,
You know, of course, that the others think you're weak, and not particularly bright.
Celine almost choked on a blueberry.
If it were up to most of the circle, you wouldn't be in it. Fortunately, this isn't a democracy. They think they know you, Celine, but they don't know the half of it, do they?
Slowly she shook her head. No one knew her. Not really.
I, on the other hand, believed in you. I trusted you. And you repay this trust with suspicion?
I really didn't.
Of course you had no suspicions. You just thought you'd pay a social call, behind my curtains, while I was out.
Okay. Oui. I was suspicious.
See? You are smart.
That smile again, warm and approving like she'd fulfilled his intentions.
And what is it you discovered about me with your intrepid investigation?
There was no point in pretense. And Celine was almost as curious as she was terrified, so she told the truth as she'd surmised it.
Dominique Dufoy wasn't in business with two shadow hunters, she was in business with you. You're trying to set someone up, and you're using us to do it.
Us? Me, Robert, Stephen.
Robert and Stephen, yes. I'm indeed using them. But you, you're here, aren't you? You're getting the full story.
I am?
If you want it.
Celine had not had the kind of parents who read her fairy tales, but she'd read enough of them herself to know the cardinal rule of these stories. Be careful what you wish for. And like every shadow hunter, she knew all the stories are true.
I want to know, she said.
He told her she was right. He was framing two shadow hunters, innocent of these crimes but guilty of a much larger one, standing in the circle's way.
They're bogged down in tradition. They're beholden to the Clave's corruption, and they're dead set on destroying me. So I acted first.
He used the warlock to plant evidence, he admitted. Now he would use Stephen and Robert as witnesses to her confession.
Since she is, unfortunately, no longer able to testify.
What about the mortal sword? Celine asked. Aren't you worried what will happen when the accused shadow hunters are interrogated? Valentine tisked, as if disappointed that she hadn't jumped to the correct conclusion.
It's very unfortunate they'll never make it that far. I happen to know these two shadow hunters will make an escape attempt during their transport to the Silent City. They'll be killed in the ensuing chaos. Tragic.
The words sat heavy between them. Celine tried to process it. Valentine wasn't just setting up two shadow hunters, two innocent shadow hunters. He was planning to murder them in cold blood. This was an unthinkable crime for which the law would demand death.
Why are you telling me this? She said, trying to keep her voice from trembling.
What makes you think I won't turn you in, unless...
Unless he had no intention of letting her leave this apartment alive. A man who could kill two shadow hunters in cold blood could presumably kill a third. Everything in her said that she should leap to her feet, draw her weapon, fight her way out of here, run straight to the Paris Institute, tell them everything. Stop this, stop him, before he went any further.
Valentine watched her calmly, palms up on the table as if to say, Your move. She didn't move. The Verlac family who ran the Paris Institute were friends with her parents. More than once, Averilak had sought out her hiding place and dumped her back home. That first time she'd pleaded for asylum at the Institute, where all shadow hunters were supposedly guaranteed a safe home. Saline was told she was too young to make such requests, too young to know what safe meant. She was told her parents loved her, and she should stop causing them so much trouble. She owed these people nothing. Valentine, on the other hand, had singled her out, given her a mission, a family. She owed him everything. He leaned toward her, reached out his hand. She willed herself not to flinch. He touched her neck, lightly, where the achiral demon had scratched her.
"You're hurt."
"It's nothing," she said.
"And you were limping."
"I'm fine."
"If you need another Arazi."
"I'm fine."
He nodded like she'd confirmed a suspicion.
"Yes, you prefer it this way, don't you?"
"What way?"
"In pain."
Now Saline flinched.
"I do not," she insisted. "That would be sick."
"But do you know why you prefer it? Why you chase the pain?"
She had never understood this about herself, only knew it in the deep, wordless way you knew your most essential truth. There was something about pain that made her feel more solid, more real, more in control. Sometimes the pain felt like the only thing she could control.
"You covet pain because you know it makes you strong," Valentine said.
It felt like he had given name to her nameless soul.
"You know why I understand you better than the rest of them? Because we're the same. We learned early, didn't we? Cruelty, harshness, pain. No one shielded us from the realities of life, and that made us strong. Most people, they're ruled by fear. They flee the specter of pain, and that makes them weak. You and I, Saline, we know the only way through is to face pain, to invite the cruelty of the world and master it."
Saline had never thought of herself this way, hard and strong. She'd certainly never dared think of herself as anything like Valentine.
"That's why I wanted you in the circle. Robert, Stephen, the others? They're still just boys. Children playing at adult games. They haven't yet been tested. They will be, but not yet. You and I, though, we're special. We haven't been children for a long time."
No one had ever called her strong. No one had ever called her special.
"Things are accelerating," Valentine said. "I need to know who's with me and who's not. So you can see why I told you the truth about this." He gestured to the singed heap of Warlock clothes. "Situation."
"It's a test," she guessed. "A loyalty test?"
"It's an opportunity," he corrected her. "To invite you into my confidence and reward you for yours. My proposal, you stay silent about what you've learned here, and allow events to proceed as I intend. And I will deliver you Stephen Herondale on a silver platter."
"What?
I told you, Saline. I know things. I know you. And I can give you what you want. If you really want it."
"Be careful what you wish for," she thought again. But oh, she wished for Stephen. Even knowing what he thought of her, even with his mocking laughter ringing in her ears, even believing what Valentine said, that she was strong and Stephen was weak, even knowing what she knew to be true, that Stephen did not love her and never would, she wished for him, always and forever.
"Or you can leave this apartment, run to the Clave, tell them whatever story you like, save these two innocent shadow hunters, and lose the only family who's ever truly cared about you," Valentine said. "The choice is yours."
Tessa Gray breathed in the city that had once briefly but indelibly been her home. How many nights had she stood on this same bridge, gazing at the hulking shadow of Notre Dame, the rippling waters of the Seine, the proud scaffolding of the Eiffel Tower, all of it, Paris's heartbreaking beauty, blurred by her ceaseless tears. How many nights had she searched the river for her ageless reflection, imagining the seconds, days, years, centuries she might live, and every one of them in a world without Will?
No, not imagining. Because it had been unimaginable. Unimaginable. But here she was. More than 50 years later, still living, still without him, heart forever broken yet still beating. Still strong. Still capable of love. She'd fled to Paris after he died, stayed until she was strong enough to face her future, and hadn't been back since. On the face of things, the city hadn't changed. But then, on the face of things, neither had she. You couldn't trust the face of things to show you their truth. You didn't have to be a shapeshifter to know that. I'm so sorry, Tessa. I had her, and I let her go. Even after all these years, she wasn't used to it. This cold version of Jem's voice speaking inside her mind, at once so intimate and so far away. His hand rested on the railing bare inches from hers. She could have touched him. He wouldn't pull away, not from her. But his skin would be so cold, so dry, like stone. Everything about him like stone. You found her. That's what we set out to do, right? This was never about bringing the lost Herondale back to the Shadowhunter world, or choosing a path for her. There was comfort in the familiar weight of the jade pendant around her neck, warm against her chest. She still wore it, every day, as she had since the day Jem gave it to her, more than a century before. He didn't know.
What you say is true, but still, it does not seem right for a Herondale to be in danger while we do nothing.
I fear I failed you, Tessa, that I have failed him. Between her and Jem, there was only ever one him. We found her for Will, and you know Will would want her to choose for herself, just like he did. If he had still been Holy Jem, she would have put her arms around him. She would have let him feel, in her embrace, her breath, her heartbeat, how impossible it was for him to fail either her or Will. But he was both Jem and not Jem. Both himself and unfathomably other, and she could only stand beside him, assure him with useless words that he had done enough. He'd warned her once what would happen as he became less himself, more silent brother, promised her that the transformation would never be complete. When I no longer see the world with my human eyes, I will still be, in some part, the Jem you knew, he had said. I will see you with the eyes of my heart. When she looked at him now, his sealed eyes and lips, his cold face, when she breathed in his inhuman smell, like paper, like stone, like nothing that had ever lived or loved, she tried to remember this. She tried to believe that some part of him was still in there, seeing her and longing to be seen. It got harder every year. There had been moments over the decades when the Jem she remembered truly broke through. Once, during one of the mundane world's innumerable wars, they had even stolen a kiss. And almost more. Jem had pushed her away before things could go too far. After that, he'd held himself more distant from Tessa, almost as if afraid of what might happen if he let himself near the brink. That embrace, which she thought about almost every day, was more than 40 years ago now. And every year, he seemed a little less Jem, a little less human. She feared he was forgetting himself, piece by piece. She could not lose him, not him too. She would be his memory. I met a girl here, he said, in love with a Herondale. She imagined she could hear a faint smile in his voice. Did she remind you of anyone? Tessa teased. Her love seemed to cause her great pain. I would have liked to help her. It was one of the things she loved about him, his abiding desire to help anyone in need. This was something the Silent Brotherhood could not strip away. I used to come to this bridge all the time, you know, when I lived in Paris, after Will. It is very peaceful here, and very beautiful. She wanted to tell him that wasn't it. She hadn't come for the peace or the beauty. She'd come because this bridge reminded her of the Black Friars Bridge, the bridge that belonged to her and Jem. She'd come because standing here, suspended between land and water, her hands tight on the iron railing, her face raised to the sky, reminded her of Jem. The bridge reminded her that there was still someone in the world that she loved, that even if half of her heart was gone forever, the other half was still here. Unreachable, maybe, but here. She wanted to tell him, but she couldn't. It wouldn't be fair. He would be asking something of Jem that he couldn't deliver, and the world had already asked far too much of him. He would have hated it, the idea of a Herondale out there somewhere who thinks she can't trust the Shadow Hunters, who thinks we're the villains. He might well have understood. It was true, Will himself had been raised to distrust the Shadow Hunters. He knew, better than most, how harshly the Glaive treated those who turned their backs on it. He would have been enraged to learn about this lost branch of his family at the thought of the Glaive attempting to execute a mother and child for a father's sins. Tessa feared for the safety of this lost Herondale, but just as much, she longed to persuade her that some Shadow Hunters could be trusted. She wanted to make this young woman understand that they weren't all hard and unfeeling, that some of them were like Will. "I get so angry at them sometimes, the Shadow Hunters who came before us, the mistakes they made. Think how many lives have been ruined by the choices of an earlier generation." She was thinking of Tobias Herondale, but also Axel Mortmain, whose parents had been murdered in front of him, and Aloysius Starkweather, who'd paid for that sin with his granddaughter's life. She was thinking even of her own brother, whose mother had refused to claim him as her own, who might have found his way to being a better man had he been better loved. It would be unjust to blame the past for choices made in the present, nor can we justify present choices by invoking the sins of the past. You and I know that better than most. Jem, too, had seen his parents murdered in front of him. Jem had endured a life of pain, but he'd never let himself be warped by it, never turned to revenge or vindictiveness. And Tessa had been conceived as a demonic tool, literally. She could have chosen to accept this fate. She could have chosen to flee the shadow world altogether, return to the mundane life she'd once known and pretend she did not see the darkness. Or she could have claimed that darkness as her own. She'd chosen a different path. They both had. "We always have a choice," Jem said, and for once, the voice in her mind sounded like him, warm and close. "It's not always the choice we would want, but it's a choice nonetheless. The past happens to us, but we choose our future. We can only help that our lost Herondale ultimately chooses to save herself."
"That's the best hope for any of us, I suppose."
Jem slid his hand across the railing and rested it atop hers. It was, as she knew it would be, cold, inhuman. But it was also Jem, flesh and blood, undeniably alive. And where there was life, there was hope. Maybe not now. Not yet. But someday. They could still have their future. She chose to believe it. The Church of Saint-Germain-des-Prés was founded in 558 AD. The original abbey was built on the ruins of an ancient Roman temple, then destroyed 2 centuries later in a Norman siege. Rebuilt in the 10th century AD, the church has now endured, in one form or another, for a millennium. The Merovingian kings are buried in its tombs, as is the torn-out heart of John II Casimir Vasa and the headless body of René Descartes. Most mornings, the abbey saw a steady trickle of tourists and observant locals wandering through its apse, lighting candles, bowing heads, whispering prayers to whoever might be listening. But this particular drizzly August morning, a sign on the door indicated the church was closed to the public. Inside, the Paris conclave had assembled. Shadow hunters from all across France listened solemnly to charges lodged against two of their own. Jules and Lisette Montclair stood silently, heads bowed, as Robert Lightwood and Stephen Herondale testified to their crimes. Their daughter, Celie Montclair, was not called upon to speak. She had, of course, not been present for the warlock's revelation of her parents' crimes. The scene played out as if Valentine had scripted it himself, and like everyone else present, Celine did exactly as Valentine intended. Nothing. Inside, she was at war with herself, furious at Valentine for making her complicit in her parents' destruction. Furious with herself for sitting silently as their fates were sealed. More furious at her own instinct for mercy. After all, her parents had never shown any to her. Her parents had done their best to teach her that mercy was weakness and cruelty was strength. So she steeled herself to be strong. Told herself this wasn't personal. This was about protecting the circle. If Valentine believed this was the righteous way forward, then this was the only way forward. She watched her parents quaver with fear under the steely eye of the Inquisitor, and she remembered the two of them backing away from her, ignoring her cries, closing her into darkness. And she said nothing. She sat very still, head lowered, and endured. They had taught her that too. The Shadow Hunters of France all knew Celine, or thought they did. That sweet and obedient daughter of the Provençal countryside. They knew how devoted she was to her parents. Such a dutiful daughter. She would, of course, inherit their estate. Celine bore the weight of the stares with dignity. She did not acknowledge the pitying looks. She kept her eyes on the floor when the judgment was issued and so did not see the horror on her parents' faces. She did not watch them placed in the custody of the Silent Brothers, to be transported to the Silent City. She did not expect them to survive long enough to face the mortal sword. She did not speak to Robert or Stephen, and let them believe this was because they had just consigned her parents to death. Valentine caught up with Celine just outside the church. He offered her Nutella crepe.
"From the stand across from Les Deux Magots," he said. "Your favorite, right?"
She shrugged, but took what he had to offer. The first bite, warm chocolate hazelnut, sweet pastry, was as perfect as ever. Made her feel like a child again. Sometimes it was difficult to believe she had ever been young.
"You could have told me," she said. "And ruin the surprise."
"Those are my parents."
"Indeed. And you've killed them." "They're still alive, last I checked," Valentine said. "They could probably stay that way with a word from you, but I didn't hear it."
"You took a pretty big risk, not telling me the whole story, expecting me to let them go.
"Did I?" he said. "Or did I simply know you well enough to know exactly what you would choose? To know I was doing you a favor."
He met her eyes. She could not look away. For the first time, she didn't want to.
"You don't have to admit it, Celine. Just know that I know. You're not alone in that."
He saw her. He understood. It was as if a muscle she'd been clenching her entire life finally released.
"A deal's a deal, though," he said. "Even if you got more than you bargained for, Stephen is all yours, assuming that's still what you want."
"How exactly would you make that happen?" she asked, clear now on exactly what Valentine was capable of.
You wouldn't hurt him, would you?"
Valentine looked disappointed in her.
"Stephen is my closest friend, my most trusted lieutenant. The fact that you would even ask that makes me question your loyalty, Celine." "Do you want me questioning your loyalty?"
She shook her head. Then that warm, buttery smile broke over his face again. She couldn't tell whether this was the real Valentine breaking through or the mask dropping back over his face.
"On the other hand, it would be foolish of you not to ask. And as we've discussed, there's nothing foolish in you, no matter what people might think. So, your answer, no. I swear to you, on the angel, I will cause Stephen no harm in the enactment of this agreement."
"And no threat of harm?"
"Do you think so little of yourself that you assume a man would need to be threatened with harm before he could love you?"
She didn't answer. She didn't need to. He could surely read it all over her face.
"Stephen is with the wrong woman," Valentine told her almost gently. "Deep down, he knows that. I'll simply make this as clear to him as it is to us, and the rest will be as easy as falling off a cliff. You need only relax,
and let gravity do its work. Don't be afraid to reach for the things you really want, Celine. It's beneath you. What she really wanted. It wasn't too late to speak up, to save her parents. Or she could keep her word and keep his secret. She could let her parents pay for what they'd done to her, for the lattice of scars on her skin and her heart, for the ice in her blood. If she was the kind of daughter who could consign her parents to death, then they had no one to blame but themselves. But that didn't mean she had to accept the entire bargain. Even if she stayed silent, she could walk away, away from Valentine, now that she knew what he was capable of. Away from Stephen, now that she knew what he thought of her. She could close the door on the past, start again. She could choose a life without pain, without suffering or fear. But who would she be without pain? What was strength if not the endurance of suffering? There is nothing more painful than love denied, the strange silent brother had told her. A love that cannot be requited. I can think of nothing more painful than that. If Valentine said he could give her Stephen Herondale, he meant it. Celine did not doubt this. He could do anything, and that included finding a way to force Stephen Herondale into her life and her arms. But even Valentine could not make Stephen love her. To have Stephen would mean not having him. It would mean knowing in every moment, every embrace, that he wanted someone else. It would mean a lifetime of longing for the one thing she could not have. The silent brother was wise and spoke the truth. There could be no greater pain than that. Take your time, Valentine said. It's a big choice. I don't need time, she told Valentine. I want it. I want Stephen. It didn't feel like choosing, because it was the only choice she had.
Son of the Dawn.
New York City, 2000. Every world contains other worlds within it. People wander through all the worlds they can find, searching for their homes. Some humans thought their world was the only world there was. Little did they know of other worlds as close to their own as a room, with the demons trying to find a door through to them, and the shadow hunters who barred those doors. Still less did they know of the downworld, the community of magical creatures who shared their world and carved out their own little space therein. Every community needs a heart. There had to be a common area where everyone could gather, to trade for goods and secrets, to find love and riches. There were shadow markets, where downworlders and those with the sight met all over the world. Usually they were held outside. Even magic was a little different to New York. The abandoned theater on Canal Street had stood since the 1920s, silent witness to, but not part of the blaze of activity that was the city. Humans who did not have the sight passed by its terracotta facade in a hurry about their own affairs. If they spared the theater a look, they thought it as dark and still as ever. They could not see the haze of fairy light that turned the gutted amphitheater and bare concrete halls to gold. Brother Zechariah could. He walked, a creature of silence and darkness, through the halls with sunshine yellow tiles, panels of gold and red blazing on the ceiling above him. There were busts grimy with age set in alcoves along the walls, but for tonight, fairies had coaxed flowers and ivy to twine around them. Werewolves had set little twinkling charms depicting the moon and stars in the boarded windows, lending brightness to the decayed red curtains still hanging in the arched frames. There were lamps with casements that reminded Brother Zechariah of a time long ago, when he and all the world had been different. In one vast echoing theater room there hung a chandelier that had not worked in years, but tonight warlock magic had encompassed each bulb with a different colored flame. Like burning jewels, amethyst and ruby, sapphire and opal, their light created a private world that seemed both new and old, and restored the theater to all its former glory. Some worlds only lasted one night. If the market had the power to lend him warmth and illumination for only a night, Brother Zachariah would have taken it. A persistent fairy woman had tried to sell him a love charm 4 times. Zachariah wished such a charm would work on him. Creatures as inhuman as he did not sleep, but sometimes he lay down and rested, hoping for something like peace. It never came. He spent his long nights feeling love slip through his fingers, more a memory by now than a feeling. Brother Zachariah did not belong to the downworld. He was a shadow hunter, and not only a shadow hunter, but one of the cloaked and hooded brotherhood dedicated to arcane secrets in the dead, sworn and ruined to silence and withdrawal from any world. Even his own kind often feared the Silent Brothers, and downworlders usually avoided any shadow hunter. But the downworlders were used to the presence of this particular shadow hunter at markets now. Brother Zachariah had been coming to shadow markets for 100 years, on a long quest that even he had begun to believe would be fruitless. Yet he continued searching. Brother Zachariah had little enough, but one thing he did have was time, and he had always tried to be patient. Tonight, though, he had already been disappointed. The warlock Ragnar Fell had no word for him. None of his few other contacts, painstakingly gathered over the decades, had attended this market. He was lingering not because he was enjoying the shadow market, but because he remembered enjoying markets once. They had felt like an escape, but Brother Zachariah hardly remembered the wish to escape from the City of Bones where he belonged. Always in the back of his mind, cold as a tide waiting to wash all other things away, were the voices of his brothers. They were urging him home. Brother Zachariah turned under the glitter of diamond pane windows. He was leaving the market, making his way through the laughing, bargaining crowd when he heard a woman's voice saying his name.
"Tell me again why we want this, Brother Zachariah. The normal Nephilim are bad enough. Angel in the veins, stick up the butts, and I bet with the Silent Brothers it's a whole staff. We definitely can't take him out for karaoke."
The woman was speaking in English, but a boy's voice replied to her in Spanish.
"Quiet, I see him."
It was a pair of vampires, and as he turned, the boy lifted a hand to attract Zachariah's attention. The vampire with his hand up looked 15 years old at most, and the other like a young woman, about 19. But that told Zachariah nothing. Zachariah still looked young, too. It was unusual for a strange downworlder to want his attention.
"Brother Zachariah," asked the boy, "I came here to meet you."
The woman whistled.
"Now I see why we might want him. Hello, Brother Zachariah."
"Did you?" Brother Zachariah asked the boy. He felt what would once have been surprise, and now was at least intrigue. "Can I be of any use to you?"
"I certainly hope so," said the vampire. "I am Raphael Santiago, second in command of the New York clan, and I dislike useless people."
The woman waved her hand.
"I'm Lily Chen. He's always this way."
Brother Zachariah studied the pair with new interest. The woman had hair streaked neon yellow and wore a scarlet capo that suited her, and despite her own remarks, she was smiling at her companion's words. The boy's hair was curly, his face sweet, and his air disdainful. There was a burn scar at the base of his throat where a cross might lie.
"I believe we have a mutual friend," said Brother Zachariah.
"I don't think so," said Raphael Santiago. "I don't have friends." "Oh, well, thank you very much," said the woman at his side.
"You, Lily," said Raphael coldly, "are my subordinate."
He turned back to Brother Zachariah.
"I assume you refer to the warlock Magnus Bane. He is a colleague who always has more dealings with shadow hunters than I approve of."
Zachariah wondered if Lily spoke Mandarin. The Silent Brothers, speaking mind to mind, had no need for language, but sometimes Zachariah missed his. There had been nights in the Silent City, it was always night, when he could not remember his own name, but he could remember the sound of his mother or his father or his betrothed speaking Mandarin. His betrothed had learned some of the language for him in the time when he had thought he would live to marry her. He would not have minded talking with Lily longer, but he did not particularly like her companion's attitude.
"Since you do not appear to care for shadow hunters, and you have little interest in our mutual connection," Brother Zachariah observed, "why approach me?"
"I wish to talk to a shadow hunter," said Raphael.
"Why not go to your institute?"
Raphael's lips curled back from his fangs in a sneer. Nobody sneered like a vampire, and this vampire was particularly adept. My institute, as you call it, belongs to people who are, how do I put this tactfully, bigots and murderers. A fairy selling ribbons with glamour twined in them passed by, trailing blue and purple banners.
The way you put that was not particularly tactful, Brother Zachariah felt bound to point out.
No, said Raphael thoughtfully. I am not gifted in that arena. New York has always been a place of heightened downworlder activity. The lights of the city work on people as if we are all werewolves, howling for an electric moon. A warlock tried to destroy the world here once, before my time. The leader of my clan made a disastrous experiment with drugs here against my advice and made the city her slaughter ground. The werewolves' fatal struggles for leadership are far more frequent in New York than anywhere else. The White Laws of the New York Institute understood us, and we them. The White Laws died defending downworlders from people who now occupy their institute. Of course, the Clave did not consult us when they made the punishment of the Lightwoods. We do not have any dealings with the New York Institute now.
Raphael's voice was uncompromising, and Brother Zachariah thought he should be concerned. He had fought in the uprising when a band of renegade youths rose up against their own leaders and against peace with the downworld. He had been told the story of Valentine's Circle hunting werewolves in New York City, and the White Laws getting in their way, resulting in a tragedy that even that group of angry downworlder-hating youths had not intended. He had not approved of the Lightwoods and Hodge Starkweather being banished to the New York Institute, but the word was that the Lightwoods had settled down with their three children and were truly remorseful for their past actions. The pain and power struggles of the world seemed very far away in the Silent City. It had not occurred to Zachariah that the downworlders would resent the Lightwoods so much they might decline their aid even when Shadowhunter help was truly needed. Perhaps it should have.
Downworlders and Shadowhunters have a long, complicated history full of pain, and much of the pain has been the fault of the Nephilim, Brother Zachariah admitted. Yet through the ages, they have found a way to work together. I know that when they followed Valentine Morgenstern, the Lightwoods did terrible things. But if they are truly repentant, could you not forgive them?
Being a damned soul, I have no moral objection to the Lightwoods, said Raphael in deeply moralistic tones. I do have strong objections to my head being cut off, given the least excuse the Lightwoods would lay waste to my clan.
The only woman Zachariah had ever loved was a warlock. He had seen her weep over the circle and its effect. Brother Zachariah had no reason to support the Lightwoods, but everyone deserved a second chance if they wanted that chance enough. And one of Robert Lightwood's ancestors had been a woman called Cecily Herondale.
Say they would not, suggested Brother Zachariah. Would it not be preferable to reestablish relations with the Institute rather than hope to catch a silent brother at the Shadow Market?
Of course it would, said Raphael. I fully recognize that this is not an ideal situation. This is not the first stratagem I have been forced to employ when I required an audience with Shadow Hunters. 5 years ago, I had coffee with a visiting Ashdown.
He and his companion shared a shudder of distaste.
I absolutely hate the Ashdowns, remarked Lily. They are so tedious. I believe that if I fed on one of them, I would nod off halfway through.
Raphael gave her a warning look.
Not that I would ever dream of non-consensually drinking the blood of any Shadow Hunter because it would violate the Accords,
Lily informed Brother Zachariah in a loud voice.
The Accords are deeply important to me.
Raphael shut his eyes, a briefly pained expression crossing his face, but after an instant he opened them and nodded.
So how about it, Brother Lipsmacariah? Will you help us out?
Lily asked brightly. A cold weight of disapproval made itself known from his silent brethren, like stones being pressed against his mind. Zachariah was allowed a great deal of latitude for a silent brother, but his frequent visits to the Shadow Markets and his annual meeting with the lady on Blackfriars Bridge were already testing the limits of what could be allowed. If he began consorting with downworlders on issues that could be handled perfectly well by an institute, Brother Zachariah's privileges were in danger of being suspended. He could not risk missing that meeting. Anything but that.
The Silent Brothers are forbidden to interfere with the affairs of the outside world. Whatever your problem is, said Brother Zachariah, I strongly urge you to consult with your institute.
He bowed his head and began to turn away.
My problem is werewolves smuggling Yin Fen into New York, Raphael called after him. Ever heard of Yin Fen?
The bells and songs of the Shadow Market seemed to go quiet. Brother Zechariah turned sharply back to the two vampires. Rafael Santiago stared at him with glittering eyes, which left Brother Zechariah in no doubt that Rafael knew a good deal about Zechariah's own history.
Ah, said the vampire. I see you have.
Zechariah usually tried to preserve memories of his mortal life, but now he had to make an effort to banish the intruding horror of waking up as a child with all he loved dead and silver fire burning in his veins.
Where did you hear about the Yin Fen?
I don't intend to tell you, said Raphael. Nor do I intend to let that stuff be freely available in my city. A large quantity of Yin Fen is on its way to the city on board a ship carrying cargo from Shanghai, Ho Chi Minh, Vienna, and Idris itself. The ship unloads at the New York passenger ship terminal. Will you help me or not?
Raphael had already mentioned the leader of his clan performing disastrous experiments with drugs. Zachariah's guess was that many potential customers among the Downworld were talking about the shipment of Yin Fen at the market. The fact a Downworlder with conservative views had heard about it was sheer luck.
I will help you, said Brother Zechariah, but we must consult with the New York Institute. If you wish, I can go with you to the Institute and explain matters. The Lightwoods will appreciate the information and you offering it. This is an opportunity to improve relations between the Institute and all the Downworlders in New York.
Raphael did not look convinced, but after a moment he nodded. You will go with me? He asked. You will not fail. They would not listen to a vampire, but I suppose it's possible they will listen to a silent brother.
I will do whatever I can, said Brother Zechariah.
Cunning crept into Raphael's voice. And if they don't help me, if they or even the clave refuse to believe me, then what will you do?
Then I will still help you,
said Brother Zechariah, ignoring the chill howl of his brethren in his mind and thinking of Tessa's clear eyes. He dreaded missing a meeting with Tessa, but when he did meet her, he wanted to face her with no stain upon him. He could not let any child suffer what he had suffered, not if he could prevent it. Zechariah was not able to feel all he had felt when he was mortal, but Tessa could still feel. He could not let her be disappointed in him. She was the last star he had to steer by.
I'll come to the Institute with you, Lily volunteered.
You will do no such thing, snapped Raphael. It is not safe, remember? The Circle attacked Magnus Bane.
The ice in Raphael's voice could have laid the whole of New York City under frost for a week in midsummer. He eyed Brother Zechariah with disfavor.
Magnus invented your portals, not that he receives any credit for it from Shadowhunters. He is one of the most powerful warlocks in the world, and so tender-hearted he rushes to the aid of vicious killers. He is the best the Downworld has to offer. If the Circle targeted him, they would cut down any one of us.
Would have been a damn shame, Lily confirmed. Magnus throws an amazing rager, too.
I wouldn't know, said Raphael, casting a look of distaste upon the joyful riot of the market. I do not enjoy people or gatherings.
A werewolf wearing an enchanted papier-mâché full moon head shoved past Raphael, shouting,
Ooh!
Raphael turned to look at him. And the werewolf backed away with his hands up, mumbling,
Sorry, my mistake.
Despite slight fellow feeling with the werewolf, Brother Zechariah unbent a little at this evidence that this vampire was not entirely awful.
I understand that you value Magnus highly. So do I. Once he hated someone very dear to—
No, I don't, Raphael interrupted. And I don't care about your story. Don't tell him I said any of that. I can have my opinions on my colleagues. Does not mean I have personal feelings about them.
Hey, my man, great to see you,
said Ragnar Fell, passing by. Raphael paused to fist bump the green warlock before Ragnar disappeared among the stalls and sounds and many-colored lights of the market. Lily and Brother Zechariah regarded him.
He is another colleague, Raphael protested.
I like Ragnar,
said Brother Zechariah.
Good for you, snapped Raphael. Revel in your hobby of liking and trusting everyone. It sounds as appealing to me as sunbathing.
Zechariah felt he had become acquainted with another reason beside Magnus's evil vampire ex, why Magnus always seemed to develop a migraine when people mentioned the vampire clan of New York in his presence. He, Lily, and Raphael strolled through the market.
Love charm for the handsomest silent brother?
Asked the fairy woman for the fifth time, leering through her dandelion clock hair. Sometimes one could wish the Shadow Market had not become quite so comfortable with him. He remembered this woman, he thought, dimly, recollecting her herding a golden-haired child. It had been so long ago. He had cared very much at the time. Lily snorted.
I hardly think Brother Beast with Two Backs Orion needs a love charm.
Thank you, but no, Brother Zachariah told the fairy woman. I am very flattered, though Brother Enoch is a fine figure of a man.
Or perhaps you and the lady would enjoy some phoenix tears for a night of burning pet.
She went suddenly silent, and the whole stall scuttled away across the bare concrete floor on little chicken feet.
Oops, never mind, didn't see you there, Raphael.
Raphael's thin eyebrows went up and down like a guillotine.
More of a buzzkill than the Silent Brother, murmured Lily. Oh, the shame.
Raphael looked smug. In Zachariah's head, Brother Enoch was annoyed at being the subject of a joke. The gleam and whirl of the Shadow Market shone with pale radiance in Brother Zachariah's eyes. He did not like the thought of Yun Fen spreading like wildfire in another city, killing fast as flame, or slowly as choking smoke. If it was coming, he had to stop it. This trip to the market had been useful after all. If he could not feel, he could act. Perhaps tomorrow night the Lightwoods will earn your trust, said Brother Zachariah as he and the vampire stepped out into the mundane bustle of Canal Street. Raphael said,
unlikely.
I have found it always better to hope than despair, said Brother Zachariah mildly. I will wait for you outside the Institute. Behind them, enchanted lights shimmered and the sound of fairy music rang through the halls of the theater. A mundane woman turned to face the building. Glittering blue light fell in a strange beam across her unseeing eyes. The two vampires were heading east, but partway up the street, Raphael turned back to where Brother Zachariah stood. In the night, away from the market lights, the vampire's scar was white and his eyes were black. His eyes saw too much.
Hope is for fools. I will meet you tomorrow night, but remember this, Silent Brother, he said. Hate like that does not fade. The work of the Circle is not done yet. The Morgenstern legacy will claim more victims. I do not intend to be one of them.
Wait, said Brother Zachariah. Do you happen to know why the ship is unloading its cargo at the passenger ship terminal?
Raphael shrugged. I told you the ship was carrying cargo from Idris. I believe some Shadow Hunter brat is on board.
Brother Zachariah walked away from the market alone, thinking of a child on a ship with deadly cargo and the potential of more victims. Isabel Lightwood was not accustomed to feeling nervous about anything, but anyone might be apprehensive when faced with the prospect of a new addition to the family. This was not like before Max was born, when Isabel and Alec had laid bets on whether it would be a boy or a girl, and afterward Mom and Dad trusted them enough to let them take turns holding him, the smallest and tenderest bundle imaginable. A boy older than Isabel was being dumped on their doorstep and was supposed to live with them. Jonathan Wayland, the son of Dad's parabatai, Michael Wayland. Far away in Idris, Michael Wayland had died, and Jonathan needed a home. For herself, Isabel was a little excited. She liked adventure and company. If Jonathan Wayland was as much fun and as good a fighter as Aline Penhallow, who came to visit sometimes with her mother, Isabel would be glad to have him. Except there was not just Isabel to consider. Her parents had been fighting over Jonathan Wayland ever since the news of Michael's death came. Isabel gathered Mom had not liked Michael Wayland. She was not sure Dad had liked him much either. Isabel herself had never met Michael Wayland. She had never even known that Dad had a parabatai. Neither Mom nor Dad ever talked about when they were young, except that Mom had once said they made many mistakes. Isabel sometimes wondered whether they had been mixed up in the same trouble as their tutor, Hodge. Her friend Aline said Hodge was a criminal. Whatever her parents had or had not done, Isabel did not think her mother wanted Jonathan Wayland to be a reminder of her mistakes in her own home. Dad did not seem happy when he talked about his parabatai, but he did seem determined that Jonathan would come to live with them. Jonathan had nowhere else to go, Dad insisted, and he belonged with them. That was what being parabatai meant. Once, when she was eavesdropping on them shouting, Isabel heard Dad say, I owe Michael this. Mom agreed to let Jonathan come for a trial period, but now that the shouting had died down, she was not really speaking to Dad. Isabel was worried about both her parents and especially her mom. Isabel also had to consider her brother. Alec did not like new people. Whenever new Shadowhunters arrived from Idris, Alec would mysteriously slope off. Once, Isabel had found him lurking behind a large vase, claiming he got lost trying to find the training room. Jonathan Whalen was taking a ship to New York. He should be in the Institute by the morning after next. Isabel was in the training room practicing with her whip and pondering the problem of Jonathan Whalen when she heard rushing footsteps and her brother Alec poked his head around the door. His blue eyes were sparkling.
Isabel, he said, come quickly. There's a silent brother meeting with mom and dad in the sanctuary and a vampire.
Isabel ran to a room to get out of her gear and into a dress. The silent brothers were fancy company, almost as if the consul had come to visit. By the time she got downstairs, Alec was already in the sanctuary observing the proceedings, and her parents were deep in conversation with the silent brother. Isabel heard her mom say something to the silent brother that sounded like,
yogurt? Unbelievable!
Maybe not yogurt. Maybe it was a different word.
On the ship with Michael's son, Dad said.
It couldn't be yogurt, unless Jonathan Whalen had a very serious allergy to dairy. The silent brother was a lot less scary than Isabel had been expecting. In fact, from what Isabel could see beneath the hood, he resembled one of the Mundy singers she had seen in posters around the city. From the way Robert was nodding at him and Maris was leaning toward him in her chair, Isabel could see they were getting along. The vampire was not conversing with their parents. He was leaning against one of the walls, arms crossed and glaring at the floor. He did not seem as if he was interested in getting along with anyone. He looked like a kid, hardly older than they were, and he would have been almost as handsome as the silent brother if not for his sour expression. He was wearing a black leather jacket to go with his scowl. Isabel wished she could see his fangs.
Can I offer you a coffee?
Maris said to the vampire in a cool, stilted tone.
I do not drink coffee, said the vampire.
Odd, said Maris.
I heard you had a delightful coffee with Catherine Ashdown. The vampire shrugged. Isabel knew vampires were dead and soulless and all, but she did not see why they had to be so rude. She nudged Alec in the ribs.
Get a load of the vampire, can you believe that?
I know,
Alec whispered back.
Isn't he amazing?
What?
Isabel said, grabbing Alec's elbow. Alec did not glance at her. He was studying the vampire. Isabel started to get the same uneasy feeling that she got whenever she noticed Alec looking at the same posters of Mundy singers that she did. Alec always got red and angry when she saw him looking. Isabel sometimes thought it would be nice to talk about the singers the way she'd heard Mundy girls doing, but she knew Alec wouldn't want to. Once Mom had asked them what they were looking at, and Alec had looked afraid.
Don't go near him, Isabel urged. I think vampires are gross.
Isabel was used to being able to whisper to her brother in a crowd. The vampire turned his head slightly, and Isabel remembered vampires did not have pathetic hearing like mundanes. The vampire could definitely hear her. This nasty realization caused Isabel to relax her hold on Alec. She watched in horror as he pulled away from her and advanced with nervous determination toward the vampire. Not wanting to be left out, Isabel trailed a few steps behind him.
Hello, said Alec. It's, very nice to meet you.
The vampire boy gave him a 1,000-yard stare that suggested 1,000 yards was too close up, and the vampire wished he were enjoying blissful solitude in the far reaches of space.
Hello. I'm Alexander Lightwood, said Alec.
Grimacing, as if the introduction were vital information being tortured out of him, the vampire said,
I am Raphael.
When he made that face, Isabel did see the fangs. They were not as cool as she had hoped.
I'm basically 12, continued Alec, who was totally 11. You don't look a lot older than me, but I know it's different with vampires. I guess you kind of stay the same age you stop at, though, right? Like you're 15, but you've been 15 for 100 years. How long have you been 15?
Raphael said flatly, I am 63.
Oh, said Alec. Oh, that's cool.
He advanced several steps toward the vampire. Raphael did not take a step back, but he looked like he wanted to.
Also, Alec added shyly, your jacket is cool.